Welcome back, everybody, to the Young Turks. John Arula, still in. Ben Mankiewicz, Michael Shore joining me for what should be a fun hour. We actually have one or two stories that are obviously consequential. I mean, we don't cover complete nonsense here, but a little bit of fun. We haven't had a ton of fun since the election, but we will have a little bit of fun. We won't start off with that, unfortunately, but we're going to give you updates on a lot of stuff. We're going to do a focus on one particular area of health insurance that would be massively affected if the House's version of the HCA becomes law. We're going to talk a little bit about World Refugee Day and the work that one of the hosts at TYT did for that. And then House of Cards finally comes back up in national politics in an unexpected place. We'll show that after our first break. But in the very beginning, before we get into all of that, we do have a little bit of relatively breaking news. There was an incident at the Brussels Central Station Tuesday night there in Brussels, obviously much earlier today when we're filming this, where there were reports of one or possibly two explosions, the noise of explosions being heard. One individual that is said to have been wearing some sort of explosive vest or belt was shot. We don't know from the reports that have come out already if that person is still alive or was dead, and we've heard nothing about any casualties from whatever the incident was. As you can tell from from what I've said so far, the details are scarce at this point. But it looks like another attempt at some sort of terrorist attack at the Brussels Central Station that appears thus far to have been foiled. But
That's the main train station.
Yeah. And so obviously tragic regardless, but it looks like not as as devastating as some of the other terror attacks.
But consistent with what ISIS is saying they're doing, which is going into these European countries and
telling
transportation stations, centers and things like that. Yeah, and so obviously that's not what you want to hear, but it looks like it was resolved. And obviously the site was filled with paramedics and soldiers and cops and things like that. Lots of them on the scene, not a lot of information just yet, but something that you should be aware of. It is developing now. And with that, let's move to domestic politics. If you thought that the Republicans weren't doing anything about the opioid crisis in America, think again. They're actually planning something massive. A massive cut in federal funding for substance abuse treatment across the country, which shows that clearly they were paying attention to national concerns during this last election. And so this would actually come about as a nice little side effect of the AHCA or Trump Care, whatever you want to call it, and the cuts that would be made to Medicaid expansion that had been ongoing since the ACA was put into effect. The GOP healthcare bill would end the extra funding states get through expanded Medicaid in 2020 and place a limit on overall federal spending for the program in the future. This is one of the reasons, by the way, and we've cited this before, but we will again, that the CBO estimates that approximately 14 million people will lose their health insurance because they got it through that process that would be ended. And that obviously affects every area of those people's health insurance, but one area that doesn't get talked about nearly as much is the Medicaid influence on substance abuse treatment, including some of the most deadly substances, the opioids. Medicaid expansion accounted for over 60% of total Medicaid spending on substance abuse treatment in Kentucky, nearly half in West Virginia, nearly 60% in Michigan and Maryland, and almost a third in Rhode Island. And so if you're one of the people who got your health insurance in those states and many others through the Medicaid expansion under the ACA, you could find that once Trump Care gets passed, you suddenly don't have that money. Mm-hmm. And that's important because the substance abuse treatment is not cheap. According to one report, outpatient opioid addiction treatment that includes medication like methadone averages between $6,000 and $8,000 a year. And if you're paying out of pocket and using the most effective medicines, which are more expensive, you'll pay far more. And that means that people won't get the treatment that they're getting right now, which means that we'll have more deaths.
On the upside, on the flip side, not the upside, but the flip side is many people with heroin addictions are quite well off. So,
so they'll be fine, I guess.
Well, this would have been bad news for Rush Limbaugh, I guess.
That's true. He'll probably be okay, I would imagine. You know, part of his contract.
It's good that we finally get some details because, you know, look, these guys aren't, as I've said, and you guys agree, and I think everybody paying attention, these guys are not interested in governing. I say this all the time. They're interested in ungoverning. They're interested in undoing government. And so, you know, initially Trump proposed that. after running some of his campaign on how he'd fight the opioid epidemic, which sort of oddly became, or surprisingly and welcomely, became a campaign issue that Hillary Clinton addressed, that Bernie Sanders addressed, and that Donald Trump even.
And Kasich.
And Kasich, certainly.
Kasich a lot during
Kasich
the
primaries. Kasich a lot. Yeah. It became an issue that a number of candidates addressed. The Democrats addressed it frequently, and Trump addressed it, and Kasich perhaps more than anyone.
It's weird. They addressed it a lot in New Hampshire, which has among the highest rates, and it's next to Vermont, also does, and then it didn't really come up as much.
Administration was originally eyeing a 95% cut to the Office of National Drug Control Policy. It was one of the first things, not one of the first things, but it was an early Trump act, essentially totally defunding a federal drug control office in the middle of a nationwide opioid epidemic.
Yeah.
There was outcry from many Republican governors, including some federal Republicans, and every Democrat complaining. And then they backpedaled, and they ended up proposing $369 million for the office. And it's not the primary source of being able to fight an opioid epidemic, but it is a central office which can coordinate.
Yeah.
And if done right, would be useful. So they end up backpedaling off their 95% cut, which is draconian and cruel, and again, just shows a desire of, hey, let's just stop this department. Let's not govern here. So their new proposal was $369 million, which they made. It's a 5% cut. So again, that's not tackling a problem. Mm-hmm. The opioid epidemic broke that tackle.
Right.
And slipped away. It's a football reference, John. They're going to end up getting credit to some extent for a 5% cut in what is clearly a national crisis.
Yeah.
And it was something that these numbers were obviously upped during the previous 8 years to the Trump presidency, and the problem has gotten worse. And what you're dealing with, though, is sort of the continuation that's trickled down to the Congress too. This is a president who seems to still be, in my estimation, pissed that Barack Obama made a bunch of jokes about him at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and is trying to undo everything that happened in the 8 years of the Obama presidency.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the way that the Congress is running is the same way. They said no to it when it was proposed, and now they want to undo whatever is there and in the wrong places.
Yeah, and the sad thing is that, I mean, look, everybody, the opioid epidemic is something that is an epidemic. It affects, basically every segment of the American population. But I mean, this isn't the crack problem where Republicans can sort of tell themselves that that's just a problem for other people. I mean, how many Trump voters, enthusiastic Trump supporters, will be affected by this if this goes into effect? Poor white conservatives that theoretically could lose their health insurance, stay addicted, and possibly die unnecessarily because of what Republicans are working their butts off in secret right now to achieve. You sort of expect that the other side is going to get screwed in American politics, but when they're so enthusiastic about screwing their own voters, that's sort of perverse. And let's talk about why this needs to be addressed. And it's not just because I want to make sure that people stay focused on the AHCA and the debate that's going on right now in the Senate, or the debate that should be going on anyway. Let's bring up this next chart. We showed this recently in the Young Turks. I want to show it again. The drug-induced deaths. Now, opioids are not the only component of that, but they are the single largest component of that. And opioids, theoretically, okay, they're dangerous. There's always going to be some deaths. And so maybe you're at some point on that line. But the rise, that is because of the profit motive. And it's easy for many people, I think, that haven't experienced this. They don't know anyone in their immediate family that's experienced it. I think it's a shrinking percentage of the American population that doesn't know anybody. But there's some people that will look at that and say, at the end of the day, okay, it's not marijuana, it's not crack, but it's still drugs. And these people theoretically could have just stopped doing it. But you get on it because you hurt your back or you hurt your leg or something. And then the human ability to overcome that addiction, these are incredibly strong, incredibly addictive substances. This is not a matter of willpower. This isn't put down the muffin. This breaks down your body's ability to
stop. Which, by the
way,
I can't do. So
I can't even do that. Yeah. I can't literally do that. I've never had a drug like this. Right. I imagine I would be addicted. And that's why you see the numbers of people dying shooting up. And that is a trend that might continue, might accelerate if Trump care gets put into law. There is one other,
and of course, what that number of 60,000, nearly 60,000, or 52,000 lives nationally?
55
now. I was looking it up.
I think last year it was actually higher.
There's 15 numbers?
Yeah, I'm looking at 15 numbers.
I think it was 59,000 last year. This particular chart doesn't show that.
So 60,000. And here's what happened. A lot of people didn't die, but their lives were ruined.
Yes.
And
that,
I mean, many more.
Many more.
Well, not to mention the families of the people that are, it's
don't mention them.
I won't. I said not to, so yes. I won't. On the AHCA stuff, I know you have more on it, but the politics of it seemed to get a little bit more favorable today as a number of Republican senators leaving their weekly lunch, which they have on Capitol Hill on Tuesday, were telling reporters that they're not yes votes on this. Many more are undecided than they thought. And one reporter, Topher Spiro, counted 7 no votes from Republicans on this, which would doom the AHCA anyway, as of right now. Yeah. And they're names that you wouldn't necessarily expect. John McCain and John Cornyn. John McCain said he's not sure, of course. He threatened.
And he hates the process.
Right, he hates the process.
Yeah.
John Cornyn, you wouldn't have expected.
No.
And then some of the other names that came out of there, Susan Collins, you would. Dean Heller running for office next year in a blue state. Shelley Moore Capito. Ted Cruz and Mike Lee are names that are being bandied about as undecided. Rob Portman, undecided. Those are impressive names. Ben Sasse as well. So I think that the backlash that they've gotten for the process and stories like this and what people are saying about it.
We're going to make some presidential bets on the old school this week. Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you'll both want to be in on.
I can't Cenk do old school this week.
Cenk, well, we still can include your, we want to do a draft of.
I'll do that.
It's going to be a draft. I hope I'm not giving too much away, but it's going to be a draft of, and it gets to this, of the people who Mike Pence will ask to be his vice president, not in the campaign, but when he has to appoint a vice president.
When he has to,
it's a great.
I'm not interested in that game, Ben.
I bring up John Cornyn, not because he really even came up as a thought in that, although he might, but that I will just simply offer either of you a very simple $5 bet that I say John Cornyn votes yes on this bill.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know that I would put him at the most likely to say no out of that list, certainly. I think he'd be in the bottom 50%.
Yeah,
I can't see it.
Even though he said, this is what he said today. No.
Yeah, I know.
So,
Here's how confident I am. John Cornyn votes yes, I'll just give you $5. If it's no, nothing. You owe me nothing.
That's fine. That's a good bet.
Yeah. I will say, look, I didn't know about all those no's.
They're not all no's. Some of them are undecided. Some of them are no's.
Yeah. That is good news, and that seems to indicate that the odds aren't as high as we might have thought. And I'm not saying you're doing this, but I do remember, in the same way that I'm doing like a solid 2 weeks of every day, we got to talk about the HCA, so people will realize how devastating it would be if it passed. Back when the House was considering it for the second time, because remember, it came up and then it was killed, and then it came back. I did a story because we were doing like a solid week of it, and there was a TYT host, I'm not gonna say who was on the panel and said, why are you even talking about this? It's not gonna pass. And like within 2 days, they shoved it through the House and it passed. So don't take anything for granted. You can still put pressure on your senators. You can track down the 7 that were mentioned by Michael and hopefully stop this thing.
And there's also no Freedom Caucus in the Senate, which did make a difference in the House. And I don't think it was me who said that.
No, it was not. Okay. No, it was nobody here.
So, it was nobody who was here.
Anyway, so. There's one other aspect though. So we know almost nothing about the Senate version of the AHCA. It's entirely possible that they're going in that back room and playing Mario Kart. Would we actually know? I don't know that we would.
They're not doing that because they are adults.
They're 1,000, yeah.
And adults don't play.
It's a fun game. But we do have a little bit more information that Axios was able to confirm. So one of the areas of the House version that a lot of people had a problem with and was perversely the thing that got a lot of the conservatives on board was the state waivers for some of the protections under the ACA, that states could opt out of the things about the ACA that make it worth a damn. And now we know some of the things that will be in the Senate version, waivers that states can get for little things like providing essential health benefits or the list of 10 services insurers must cover. So essential health benefits, will not be insured. Probably not that essential anyway.
Do we know what are some of those essential benefits?
Yeah, we're actually going to get into some. I think that some of these that we'll get into the last graphic are.
All right.
The medical loss ratio, or the regulation of how much premium income insurers must spend on patient claims. So, you know, that them doing their job as insurers, trying to make sure that people get medical care, will be a lower priority after this. The age rating band. This is going to be boring, I apologize, but it's important. The requirement that premiums for older people be no more than 3 times the amount of premiums charged to younger people. Which I always love when you win an election, you gain control of every branch of government, and then you give a massive middle finger to the oldest voters. Do older people vote? I don't know if they do, maybe they do. But now 3 times as much isn't enough. Older people could get 5 times, 10 times as costly insurance. Now let's go.
They'll self-regulate and keep it to 3.
Right.
Why raise it?
Right.
And then let's jump to this last graphic. You're going to see how much you theoretically could have to pay for certain medical procedures or conditions under this new plan that's being considered. If we could bring up graphic 28. Because that text is way
too small.
Couldn't
healthcare less is a great
banner. There you go. Yeah. Is what?
It's a great banner.
Thank you. Yeah. So you're seeing there, interestingly, we just talked about drug dependency. Imagine having to pay an additional $20,000 for that if the states take the waivers. Something like I don't know what that is. Maybe it's a cancer. Pregnancy? It's probably rare, but if you get it, $17,000 additional dollars in certain states you might have to pay. I mean, depression, that's a big problem in America. 10K, that's expensive. Hemophilia, $344,000. And then certain forms of cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer. I'm sure everyone watching this knows someone who's suffered from a form of cancer. Imagine on top of all the other problems that come with that, also having to pay $30,000 to $80,000, $100,000.
I hope when this bill is finally given the light of day, and it may well be after it becomes law. But just from a political point, that breast cancer is included in the things they won't cover, but prostate cancer is. Like that would be
fit the pattern.
That would fit the pattern. That would work.
Yeah, and they go to the CBO. This goes to the CBO next week.
Right, next week.
These are the kinds of things that they will certainly look at.
Exactly. Yeah, but we also know that they're going to try to vote by Thursday. So how much time are we going to have between the CBO report coming out?
Does it go to the CBO and they vote Thursday of next week?
No, that's what I heard.
That's what they're talking about.
That's what they're talking about. And so it's important that we get this information out now, because if there is less than a day for people to put pressure, and if that's when people finally awaken, when they wake up to how terrible this bill could be, I don't know that theoretically that's enough time to stop it. So people need to put pressure on them now, and they need to not relent until it's actually killed. Anyway, we were going to go on to one more story before the first break, but I want to be able to give enough time to the videos. We're going to give you previews of Francis Maxwell's work abroad, interviewing refugees in Africa for World Refugee Day. So we are going to take our first break.
There's one little TYT made a difference political story yesterday. We talked about how there was no FEMA director. Mm-hmm. Today, a FEMA director was
there. Is a FEMA director
right after? Yeah, Brock was confirmed today. 4 senators voting against it. We've passed 95-4. Gillibrand, Warren, Brian Schatz of Hawaii, and Cory Booker voted against him. But we have a FEMA director. You know, just some weeks into hurricane season.
Some weeks. Yeah. So we'll have to look into that. I'm actually not familiar with who it is, so we'll have the details on tomorrow's show. We're going to take a break right now. Let us know what you think about these stories. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Michael, Ben, and John got some tweets I want to read for you. Referring back to the story we did about the opioid crisis and Trump Care's possible effect on it, DSM Liberal says most folks do drugs because their lives suck. Improve people's lives, you will see less drug use. Which might well be true even for a lot of people on opioids.
Yeah,
but opioids are like, you get given opioids for something you need at some point. That's the sort of insidious thing.
Again, it's a careless use of the word most. Like, A, we don't know, and two, it's not most. Yeah, sure.
Plus, but if they're not covering, you know, sickness, illness, and pain, then these people wouldn't be getting the opioids to begin with. Mm-hmm. So if there's no cover,
if there's no health insurance,
so people don't get covered for their pain, you've solved the opioid crisis because you're not giving them to anyone who need them.
It's like my theory yesterday that Trump selling $20 billion in weapons to Qatar actually stops them from using that money to support terrorism. So it's perfectly logically consistent. Okay, Gabby Morita says, hey Gabby, Trump and minions definitely don't play any sort of video or board games, referring back to the comment from Ben. Understanding game theory would make them better at their job. I don't know how much formal game theory there is in board games. I can think of one or two examples, but probably not too much.
Oh, tell us, please. And,
yeah, John, please.
There's actually a game called Dead of Winter that has a two-player variant that's actually called the game theory variant. I can give you more details if you want.
There's seven board games: Monopoly, Sorry, Candyland. Right?
I mean, second version of Sorry that you were given by somebody as a gift because they didn't know you already had Sorry.
Right, that's your other board. Right,
Trouble. I literally named 300. Anyway,
nerd.
Screaming for Change says no votes. Are reps wanting to keep their jobs and stay relevant? Glad to see the pressure is working. Yeah, and at the end of the day, like, I care but don't care on an issue as important as Trump care. At the end of the day, I don't give a fuck why Lisa Murkowski votes no. I want her to vote no.
That's so important that you say that too, John. I mean, like, it's really important. The whys don't matter, right?
Yeah.
You just want
we can break
stopped.
Down the whys later
or
at some
don't
point,
have
maybe, or
to
don't.
Sometimes, right? Yeah. I mean, sometimes it doesn't matter. It's
yeah,
just
results
stopping
matter.
Something. Results matter. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, let's jump back. Actually, before we do that, let's see. There is going to be a post game today. I believe it's Anna and Ben and Kim Horcher, I believe, are in the post game after the second hour today. Of course, available to members. If you're not currently a member of TYT, you can go to tytnetwork.com/join and become one. It's super simple. You're watching a live stream of news on the internet. You can figure this one out easily. And there is going to be a new episode of Old School tomorrow night at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific with Malcolm Fleschner, Aaron Wysocki, and Mike Sheckles. Oh, Aaron's still in town. If you've been watching for a long time, you're probably much more familiar with Aaron. Mike Sheckles,
I just found out I'm not on the show I created tomorrow night either.
Well, but you're not on it, and they're doing some vice presidential pool of Mike Pence.
Okay, you know. Right, all right.
I feel like if you come in, you can be on it. It's not that explicit.
I thought Cenk and I were back and we were both doing it tomorrow. But
that actually sounds right. It's possible that this is outdated information. Let's just assume it's true.
I don't want to take away an old school from those boys. Those guys work here? Those names you read?
I think so. I think I'm familiar with them. Okay, let's jump back to the news. Malcolm. So today is World Refugee Day, and to sort of commemorate it, I want to take a two-pronged approach to it. So the personal and the big picture on the current state of refugees internationally. We're going to get to the big picture, but I want to start personal because YouTube had this great program where they sent a number of YouTubers to refugee camps around the world to sort of provide a more detailed, human, personal look at the experiences of those people, both in the US but mostly overseas. And TYT was lucky enough to be a part of that. So TYT Sports' Francis Maxwell was chosen to go to a refugee camp in Uganda, filmed a number of videos that are available on both the Young Turks YouTube channel, also TYT Sports YouTube channel, which you should definitely watch. I've seen them, they're awesome. We're gonna show you a couple of short teasers of these videos, starting with this.
So I'm here in Uganda to look into the Biddy Biddy refugee settlement, home to around 200,000 plus South Sudanese refugees, so an astounding amount. And probably you haven't heard much of it because, let's be honest, not a lot of people are talking about it. So I believe where we're going is to the border, one of which I think there is several entry points into Uganda, but we're gonna go and see where these South Sudanese refugees are coming from. I don't know what I'm expecting. It's people literally coming across the border after just fleeing a circumstance that you probably can't even imagine.
We're gonna have a little bit more for you. There in Uganda. But as I said, I mean, there were YouTubers of a variety of different backgrounds, not exclusively focused on politics, going to refugee camps literally around the world. And so it's a great program by
there
YouTube.
Were some who did their videos in English too.
There were some.
I needed the subtitle version of that.
No, great work by France. We're still gonna bust his balls, but great work.
But it was great work.
I'm gonna take credit for one of the few good things I've done here. At this company, although it didn't really matter in the end. But Francis was been working here about a year. and he got offered another job because his talent was recognized. And he talked to me about it, and I went to Cenk, and I was like, dude, this is the kind of person you got to keep. You got to scramble. You got to keep this guy. Right. This guy matters. And Cenk was like, yeah, I totally agree. I'm already on it.
And now, after seeing this, he's going to get a better offer.
Yeah, and now he's going to. Now he's going to have to do it again.
Yeah. No, this was great. This was as good, if not. And I said this to John while it was happening, and you may have heard me speaking over it. But it was, I think, the best filmed thing I've ever seen from the Young Turks, like sort of in the field reporting. And I probably will get flack for that. But I, you know, there was
amazing
stuff.
I thought
footage
from Oslo was really good, but yeah, you might have.
I didn't see the Oslo stuff, to be honest with you. And taking nothing from the Standing Rock stuff also, that was fantastic, a lot of what came out of Standing Rock. But this was just sensitive and reporting and telling a story that literally nobody else is telling. I mean, immigration can go well someplace, that they don't have the resources for all the immigrants, but they have the sentiment to help all the immigrants, as opposed to the rest of the world where they have the resources, but they don't have.
This was a country that was starving to death, Uganda, right? And they're the ones who reached out.
Right. To the South Sudanese and what, you know. Yeah, I shouldn't even say it's the best of. There's great stuff.
It's very good.
But it's very, very good.
Yeah, one of the moments from, so there was the video on TOT Sports is focused on basically that a group of the refugees are playing soccer, football. You can attack me for both of those. To sort of like, it's a distraction. It's something to do. It's a bonding exercise. And the Ugandan field was made available so two refugee teams could play against each other. And an audience of Ugandans came to watch them play, which, and the point was made in the video, but I'm not sure that in a lot of Western countries that exact same outcome would have happened.
No, Francis, can you imagine in New York City if like tons, thousands of New Yorkers went out to see Syrians play each other in a soccer?
I would like to assume that there would be some.
But by the way, nobody would go out and see Arsenal play Chelsea either in New York. So
that's true. So. Those names sound made up. Okay, let's go to this second clip from the video.
When you talk to a lot of people, I think they expect that you have something at times to give them, and it's heartbreaking that you can't give them anything to help, and it's not a comfortable environment. It makes me feel that when I report on these stories, I'm kind of doing them an injustice even. When I report on stories in Syria, and I'm reporting it from what I've read and what I've seen, but not from what I've experienced. And now when you experience this, it's a completely different way of thinking what is actually the process. It's not just a group of people. These are actual people, human beings that are having to be resettled. And
So before we move on to the stats, though, I have to say one thing. So watching the footage, and especially, I don't know why, I don't like sports. I'm more into the football one even, because he talks to a couple of refugees about their experience and everything. It's very sad. Like, if you're a human, you have a beating heart, you're affected by that. Or at least most people are. Because the YouTube spotlight video that went up today and is sort of a montage of all of the different videos, and France is actually a big part of it. It went up, and I'm sure the numbers have changed, but as of the last time I checked it, it had 40,000 likes and well over 100,000 dislikes. And the comments were
on
the sort of...
What's it on?
On YouTube. It's the YouTube official video about this.
It's a website where
the comments are just pure Nazi rhetoric. It's just attacking... Like, the YouTube spotlight is focused on a 13-year-old girl who wants to be a rapper, an old man who makes toys for refugee children, and people have just exploded with a torrent of hatred and contempt and suspicion and xenophobia.
How
and
important,
fear,
honestly,
overwhelming fear.
John, you and I have talked about this before. Why, honestly, why do you need a comment section? Like, why, when they put something like this up here, does it matter?
Because theoretically, it could start a discussion. Some discussions are more productive than others.
But discussions were started all the time. But when you saw dogs biting kids in Birmingham in the civil rights movement, there was no comment section, but people were discussing it. People discussed things when they see them.
I think that YouTube has a lot of hope.
I think that also, I think the existence of Twitter and Facebook has rendered comment sections less meaningful. I get the idea.
That's
I know
true.
Why they
That's
were opened up,
point.
But many other websites, it seems to me, and I don't know this, but I read some story about a one news site that just stopped doing comments.
And a lot have
included
actually.
In that story was that many people are taking that approach. That there's no value in it.
Well, maybe some for some videos like this. If it's World Refugee Day, take the comments out. I mean, you're showing these
beautiful
videos.
They might well in the end.
And,
it does happen. And look, again, it's somewhere on Reddit or 4chan. They posted a link to it and said, go, this is what you're spending your day on. And I know it doesn't matter. It's not a representative sample of anything. It's just interesting that there is something about these, like being filled with hatred and fear of everything outside of what you've experienced in your life seems to be very heavily correlated with having a lot of time to spend making comments online. And being filled with hope and love and all of that, it's not as strongly correlated, it seems like, for whatever reason.
There are a lot of busy people who are filled with hate and contempt and disdain too. And France is helpless, feeling helpless there. That was moving, especially after the kids rejected his offering of pocket squares. They just didn't know what to do.
Well, they didn't understand.
And they remain to this day not dapper. Right. He actually did give them jerseys at one point, which was a nice moment.
France is a really great guy and a great TYT's lucky to have him.
Doing great work. But let's go to a little bit broader. As we mark World Refugee Day, I went and I accumulated some facts about refugees that I don't think a lot of people necessarily know. We've covered here at TYT a number of different components of the refugee crisis. And when I was in Oslo interviewing human rights activists, several of them are directly done work for particular components of the refugee crisis. But even I wasn't familiar with some of these stats. Like that more than half the refugees around the globe are under the age of 18, even though children make up just 31% of the world's population. And that was true of the video that we showed you from Uganda with Francis, that I believe 86% of the refugees in that massive camp were women and children. But of course, the image you see from those who want to demonize refugees is not quite like that. Additionally, Turkey remains the largest host of refugees globally, with nearly 3 million living inside its borders. Pakistan is second. Among the top 10 host nations, only one is a quote unquote high income country. That is Germany at number 8, with getting up there towards a million refugees and asylum seekers. And I found this to be so interesting, that the comparison of number of displaced people for every 1,000 inhabitants. I think this really drives home the image there that Sudan is at 219 to 3 per 1,000 in the UK, Canada, and Australia. And one of those two sets has more resources than the other. I will let you do the research on which is which.
But amazing.
So sorry for put that graphic back up if they could, because I want to make sure. So Sudan is home to 219 displaced people?
For every 1,000 inhabitants.
All right.
And we
is
are
that
at
Sudan, or I guess it's Sudan, because these that Francis was with were South Sudanese who were
South Sudanese fleeing into Uganda.
Uganda.
And also, just to make sure that people understand this, so there's refugees, and when you think about refugees, I mean, I hope you think about things like, for instance, the people crossing the Mediterranean from North Africa and the Middle East, those populations, people fleeing Syria and all that. But there's also a lot of internal refugees. And in 2016, there were 40.3 million internally displaced persons around the world versus 25.3 million refugees. And so these are people whose lives have also been uprooted, living in extremely hard conditions, but not necessarily getting the same sort of international recognition because they have stayed within what is quote unquote their home country. And someplace, I believe Colombia is home to millions just inside of
Colombia. That was the most surprising to me, that which was number 5, is that Colombia leads the world in the highest number of IDPs, internally displaced persons in the world.
That's
surprising to me.
What is that? That's drug war results?
It's a result of decades-long war. And we've covered a little bit of good news in the past year or two there. I don't know if it's proceeding the way that we hoped it would. But that's an idea of the scope of the problem there.
What civil war will do.
Exactly. Okay, let's move back to the US.
Well, that's what they're trying to do.
Some are.
Yeah.
We're not taking that many. That was made clear by those graphics there. Today marks a set of special elections. And so there's Georgia's 6th district. We've talked a lot about that here on TYT. But there's also, and Michael brought this up a few shows ago, there's South Carolina's 5th district, which is making news for a fairly unique reason. I hadn't known this, but South Carolina's 5th district is actually the district of Frank Underwood of House of Cards.
Now, right, he's from Gaffney.
He's from Gaffney. Turns out he's fictional, but that is the district that he originally represented. And that did not go unnoticed in the actual race in that 5th district. And so let's show a graphic. You're going to see here, this is a graphic. This is a video made by the Democrat running in that election using that pop culture connection to try to make his point.
I'm Archie Parnell. I know enough about our US tax code to bore you to tears. I know our trade laws and how to create jobs too. And I also know a few other things. We have a saying in Sumter where I'm from, never slap a man chewing tobacco. Always read the fine print. Shake with your right hand, but hold a rock with your left. The President of the United States fired the FBI director. That actually happened. It's not on the show. Whenever you get someone on the ropes, you throw a right to the gut and a left to the jaw. Donald Trump shared classified info with the Russians inside the Oval Office. Yep, that's a thing too. You see this woman? I love her more than sharks love blood.
Archie?
Even Achilles was only as strong as his heel. Sleep is for the weak.
Come to bed, Archie. It's almost 9 p.m.
There are two types of congressmen, doormats and matadors. I will be a matador for you. How'd I do?
So that's the Democrat Archie Parnell in that race.
It's pretty great.
Yeah.
Pretty great ad. I'm sure House of Cards is huge in that district.
it's a big show nationally. It's possible some people watch it. The reason I put it on the show is I just recently watched the most recent season, and it was great. And so that was very appealing to me. I don't know that he necessarily sold the character quite as well as Kevin Spacey, but. Look, we want people to try to humanize themselves. A joke with the wife is nice and all.
Look, it seems crazy. Crazy things happen in politics. I guess Trump won that district by 17 points. Generally, whose seat was it?
McMulvaney. Mulvaney had landslides.
John Spratt had it.
John Spratt. He got redistricted a little, but John Spratt had it for forever. He was a Democrat.
Yeah.
And with like a handshake, that was John Spratt's thing. I thought, like, John Spratt shook your hand.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We have a president like that.
That's true.
And so, you know, again, a Democrat had held that seat. It's not inconceivable. It seems so unlikely in the climate we live in now. But if Republicans are unmotivated and don't turn out, and you know, my hunch is that if he campaigned well and if he met people. They probably like him, right?
I'm sure they like him.
Yeah, right.
And I'm sure he won't win.
Right.
Yeah. So to put some numbers to it, Hillary Clinton lost South Carolina by nearly 19 points in 2016. And that particular district, the 5th district of South Carolina, is 19 percentage points more Republican than the nation as a whole. So that is a
Trump run. I think Trump beat Clinton by 17 points in this.
Yeah, so that's going to be rough. Now we tried to find polling. It doesn't look like there's any official polling. There was an internal poll that showed him down by 10, and it's an internal poll, which is usually somewhat more positive. So that's going to be tough. And I looked into Archie Parnell. He's got some on his campaign website. He's got some nice generic statements about a lot of issues. Previously worked as a lawyer for Goldman Sachs, so some people are going to take issue with that. And there's not a ton of specifics on a lot of the policies. I mean, he's coming from outside of politics, but I guess we'll get to that if he is able to overcome what appears to be a nearly insurmountable Republican lead in that district. But anyway, an interesting approach to campaigning. Really fast, I want to show you The last polls for the other special election going on, Georgia's 6th district, we showed you this yesterday. The most recent two polls, one has Handel up, that's the Republican up over Democrat Ossoff by 2 points, and the other has Ossoff up by 2 points as well. The reports that I was reading
earlier. So one has Handel up and one has.
Exactly, yeah.
What is Trafalgar? Is that a group. Reputable group?
It's a group.
I'm not really familiar with Trafalgar.
I'm not either. But yeah, not a lot of polling on these. And reports spread, I mean, it's anecdotal, I guess, but saying that, I guess beyond anecdotal, that turnout is unexpectedly high. It did start to rain at one point, which you never know. I mean, that theoretically does swing elections sometimes.
It all comes down to turnouts, what you're saying, John.
Basically, yes.
Which is my favorite thing in all of politics. What does the rain mean? And it all comes down to turnout.
Yeah.
One important factor here, I think 140,000 early votes came in. I think that, you know, that doesn't have to do with the weather or the turnout, and that's a big number. And you know, it's still a congressional district. It's not a state. It's not the country. So I think that with Ossoff doing as well as he was doing in the earlier polls of this race, the early votes, that's where you might see some fair. But it doesn't matter.
It's done. Polls close in 15 minutes, so we're not influencing it really anymore. But if you're thinking of getting out and voting for John Ossoff, go do it.
And you should probably run in that case.
You should run. Yeah. Drive quick, safely.
Because late voting is closing in 15 minutes.
But, you know, and to progressives who think because Ossoff isn't progressive enough for them and, you know, wouldn't support single payer and doesn't want to raise taxes. Look, this will a win for John Ossoff will embolden people on the left from moderate Democrats down to progressive Democrats. It will embolden us. It will help. It could help single-handedly. It could play a role in sending a message that defeats the AHCA. It's huge on a number of circumstances. And it will cause people to run effectively as Democrats all across the board in places where it's easier for Democrats to win and in places like where he's running where it's hard for Democrats to win.
Yeah, whoever loses this race will declare tomorrow that they're running
for the next election
is a year from November.
That's true, yeah. Our system's great. And also with Bernie Sanders stumping for him, if Ossoff wins, that is going to help Bernie Sanders' stature. Bernie has supported other candidates in these special elections in extremely difficult elections, like deep red districts. And they've made up a lot of ground, but generally haven't won. And so supporting this winner, I think, will help him out. And I know Ben mentioned this, but right now my focus is on stopping the AHCA. And I don't know that there's logically a reason why Ossoff winning should affect that, but I think that in America it probably would affect it.
Well,
it would spook some of these Republicans.
Right, that's all it was.
It sends a message to
Republicans who are not in safe districts that this vote. Yeah. Matters. And I disagree with Michael in that John Ossoff will run again if he loses because he'll be the guy who nearly won in a red district. If she loses, she's the guy who just lost to a Democrat and a district Republican should have run.
That's a possibility.
And she's also a lunchbox. So.
Yeah.
She's dumb as a lunchbox.
The other thing, and I think it's important, I mean, you don't look to South Carolina 5 that we were talking about. We're not going to take the gavel away from Paul Ryan by winning at South Carolina 5, but the Democrats are going to be able to make inroads with wins in places like this because they are going to encourage other Democrats to run in districts that might be a little closer. They're not like South Carolina 5, but there are other districts that are closer, get good candidates there. So it has a contagious effect.
If that's a plus 19 district, and suppose our buddy Archie, what's Archie's last
name?
Archie
Parnell.
Suppose he loses by.
Let me see, what's his last name?
Yeah. Suppose he loses by a 10, right? And not 19. Well, I mean, then if you have a district that swings 7, it's really not that complicated. Yeah. You might have a 2 or 3 point win in you.
Yeah.
But you got to run good candidates and you got to run good campaigns.
That's true, and we will hopefully know by tomorrow. But with that, we are going to have to take our second break of the hour. Stick with us, a lot more to get to when we come back from this. Welcome back to what remains of the first hour of the Young Turks. There were some great tweets. Unfortunately, we don't have time to read them. I wish I could, but we need to jump right back into the news. There's a lot of excitement around the country in the political nerd world anyway about an upcoming Supreme Court case That could significantly alter the future of the practice of gerrymandering in the future. And that is being driven by a case from Wisconsin where Republicans did what they do, which is get into power and then redraw all the districts to amplify their actual support into a significantly larger amount of political support or political power anyway. Back in 2012, Republicans won 48.6% of the statewide vote for assembly candidates, but captured 60 of 99 seats. In 2014, 52% of the vote yielded 63 seats. And this is after they redrew the districts to benefit themselves. And look, this is the one we're gonna focus on, but understand that this is going on around the country where if you, I mean, look, we all know that, look, Hillary Clinton got more votes than Donald Trump, but the Republican wins the presidency. Democratic Senate candidates get more votes than Republican Senate candidates, but Republicans have the Senate. Same thing in the House. Democrats get more votes in House races, but they don't have control of the House.
So we're not this last year, Republicans, I think, got more House
really?
Races.
Really? I thought yeah. I read all three. Okay.
In 2016.
And the Senate.
But it's happened, but that very thing has happened before.
Unlike all these other things, the Senate is constructed that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's sort of a structural thing.
Yeah, putting the Senate in there isn't as fair, but it's like they've created these mini electoral colleges in these states.
Basically,
through
yeah.
Gerrymandering.
Yeah, and so now the Supreme Court is going to consider this particular Wisconsin redrawing scheme that they did. In case you're not familiar with gerrymandering, which I wish that we could live in a world where you didn't have to be. Here's a picture that demonstrates the concept where you have, you know, there's 60% blue in this case, 40% red. You would imagine that if you're gonna have 5 seats, it should be split 3-2. But if you get fancy with your pen or if you use a sophisticated computer program to break down a district to the block by block level, then you can manipulate it to produce basically anything you want. Also thereby producing districts that make absolutely no sense. And that's what we have in most parts of this country. And so now the Supreme Court is gonna consider it. Theoretically, they could stop it, they could uphold it. We don't know for sure, it looks like it's gonna be close. A lot of people are excited. I'm actually very worried. And one of the reasons is there was a consideration of whether the map should be knocked down or should be stayed basically while the court case continues. And that the order granted a request, this is a vote that they already had, to stay the district court's decision. The court's 4 liberal members dissented, but Justice Kennedy was in the majority, and it appears like in many other issues, his vote is going to ultimately determine how they approach the gerrymandering broadly.
It might be telling, but he might have thought that again, that the stay shouldn't apply while the Supreme Court right. tried the case, that the law should stand as written in the Supreme Court.
Okay.
I mean,
I'm basically just going from very limited information to see if there's something we can draw.
Look, man, I am. I have PTSD from politics, so I presume that this will be a 5-4 decision in favor of Wisconsin, just because.
Right. Yeah. Cause that's right. Yeah.
That's what happens.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, but it is crazy, and all the you know, my pinned tweet for some time, and it was a joke, and really nothing but a joke, which was, I don't know why people are so frustrated with the Electoral College. It's gotten the right pick 60% of the time this century. Like it's 3 for 5, man. That's great.
Sure, everybody got the humor.
Well, I still get on a daily basis somebody saying, yeah, because we should just let, the response is almost the same. We should let, yeah, we should really let New York and California decide who's president. Well, you've just picked New York and California, but if California went Republican and the same thing happened, I'd have made the same joke. Right, because the joke's funny.
Yeah,
right.
And it's also
but they would change their minds because it wouldn't work.
Yeah,
I mean, you could. Why not say Texas and Florida? I mean, why those two states? Right. Why have you?
Yeah.
It was a flawed plan to begin with. It was a plan we came up with in the late 18th century. We have better ways to do this now.
Yeah. Theoretically, there are independent commissions.
And gerrymandering, I mean, we got a lot of problems. By the way, I'm pretty sure I'm the only person who's ever done a story about gerrymandering and then said, by the way, I have a refrigerator magnet of Elbridge Gerry.
Yeah.
Probably.
By the way, and just so you know, he was pronounced Elbridge Gerry.
He was Gerry. Yeah. That's
he
what
was
I thought.
Gerry.
I
so it's really gerrymandering.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's funny because I've always called him Elbridge Gerry and then. I was thinking, well, maybe he's Elbridge Gerry.
No, he's Elbridge.
It's like GIF and JIF. It's too late at this point. But yeah, and I've seen just a lot of people like make that same GIF point, like, oh, we should just let California decide, or they'll show the map of the physical geographic area that was won by Republicans, as if Fields vote, or as if California votes. When you say, oh, we should let California decide, what you're saying is, oh, we should let the much larger percentage of the population that lives in California decide. Yeah, probably, because we let people decide and people live in these big states.
And I guarantee that sometime in our future, a liberal candidate will win because of the way the electoral map is laid out.
I hope
not. And the
not.
More conservative candidate, and it will still be dumb.
It'll still be dumb.
Like, I am positive it'll still be dumb. And no one is saying that he doesn't get to be president. All we're saying is, hey, going forward, it's worth talking about changing it.
Yeah. And I was a supporter of the Electoral College until recently, until this election, and not because of the results of this election either, but because of how the results happened and the way I was dubious that campaigns could be run in that way and run successfully. It totally proved it to me.
It totally worked.
The balancing of what the Electoral College tries to do now is the U.S. Senate. I mean, that's the balancing. That is that's the Electoral College that matters, is that the U.S. Senate has done that way.
Yeah, I've always argued that it's like when people first discover politics and then they read about the Electoral College, they go, well, what? And they don't think that there are potentially some positives, and there are. Mm-hmm. There are some potential positives, and I've argued those in the past. But yeah, you can't override the more popular will this many times. And we were told immediately after the election, you're not allowed to talk about this now, you're just pissed about the election. Okay, it's been like 6 months. Let's talk about it now. Let's talk about getting rid of the Electoral College now that we've all simmered a bit.
It's failed twice in five times because ultimately everyone instinctively wants the person who gets the most votes to win. And I got news for you. We're closer to it sort of working out, or we're just as close to it working out as we are to Hillary won by 3 million votes. Somebody could win by 7 million votes or 7.5 or 8 million votes and lose the Electoral College. Well, and that will be galling.
And
it should already be galling.
The old argument that that the agrarian economy would suffer for because people wouldn't campaign in Kansas and Idaho because they have so few people there. Well,
they don't campaign
there now, right?
And
they go to population centers.
And they didn't really campaign there in 1789.
Well,
right. No, but I mean, as soon as we established it, nobody was going out campaigning.
No, of course.
You had no way to get there. So, I mean, every argument has adapted to the time we're in to protect the value.
But people campaigned for you, like in the 1870s, you had
people. Well, you can still have people campaign for you because they'll already be there.
And we have the internet. And everybody can watch those ads. But yeah, so the Supreme Court is going to be considering this.
And this is more important, right?
This is definitely more important now. Obviously, we're frustrated, but this is the important thing. And I get why people are optimistic, but understand that when the Supreme Court finally considers something they don't generally talk about, there's no, you never get a case where it's only potential upside. It could be really good, or it could end up being really bad. If they decide that this is totally cool, that sets a precedent that could potentially affect us for a very long time. So, very high stakes Supreme Court case that we'll keep an eye on. This is gonna have to be the last point.
I know. In the current case of gerrymandering.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I wish that we had more time to cover Sean Spicer heading off into the sunset.
There'd be plenty more opportunities to cover Sean Spicer.
That's true. Anyway, we do have to run. Thank you for joining me, guys. When we come back from this break, Anna is going to be leading the second hour. I think Ben is sticking around, and TRT Network's Nerd Alerts host Kim Horcher is going to be joining them. So that should be a lot of fun. We'll be back after this.